Accessing library computer data.
And to make sure history never forgets the name Enterprise.
Hey, everybody, welcome back to the Penske Podcast. If you haven't tuned in before, this is a podcast where we are running through all 178 episodes of Star Trek The Next Generation, giving our thoughts and feelings about each and every one. Right now, we're up to episode 19 of season 2. This one is called Manhunt. In this episode, the Enterprise must transport delegates to a conference, one of whom is an extremely man-hungry Loxana Troi, with S for Picard. This one aired back on June 19th, 1989. It was directed by Rob Bowman and written by Terry Devereaux, which is a pen name for Tracy Tormey. This one, Clay and Sean are here to join me to talk about this one. So right after this break, we're going to get into Manhunt.
Starship Enterprise, come in.
We have you on viewer pilot.
Enterprise, I have a passenger, a VIP passenger who I'm ordered
to... Oh, let me talk to them. I'm sure I'm more articulate than that.
Mother...
Captain, we are receiving Starfleet orders granting a Loxana
Troi, a daughter of the fifth house, holder of the sacred chalice of Reeks, heir to the holy rings of Beta Zed.
Full ambassadorial status, sir.
It looks like it's back into that dress uniform, sir.
And yours as well, Commander. She is listed as representing the Beta Zed government at the conference.
Mother, please don't do this to me.
Do what to you, little one? Oh, Jean-Luc. What naughty thoughts. But how wonderful you still think of me like that.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. Hope you enjoyed that audio clip. So let's get talking about Manhunt. We're going to be talking about Manhunt, the Star Trek The Next Generation episode, not the controversial video game from probably 2004 or whatever came out then.
Wait, but is this not... Manhunter, the Michael Mann movie?
No. This is going to be a very confused podcast. And if you heard that voice, you know that I have gone out because I needed some men of my own to talk about this episode. So joining me right now are my associates, Clay Nails McCormick. Clay, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. Yeah, that's all I got right now.
That's fine. And then on the other line, we have Sean Carlos Murphy from South America. Sean, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks, man.
Did you dress up? You told us you needed 5 minutes before we could start doing this, so I hope you put on a nice suit.
I had to put on my white makeup so I'd convincingly pass as a South American.
We're talking about Manhunt. Manhunt, which might be the greatest disparity between a cool name and what actually happens in the episode.
I'm going to tell you guys right now, I don't know how much I'm going to have to add to this because my page of notes is 5 notes and then a bunch of bad drawings of Riker.
Riker loves this episode. It's a, all right. So I'm just going to give my quick rundown of what happens here. The Enterprise beams aboard some alien species. They look like fish and they're comatose and they're trying to bring them to this planet to do something. They also run into Loxana Troi, Deanna's mother, who makes her return to the show after appearing in the first season. And she's entering some sort of alien menopause where she is off the charts sexually looking to find a husband. And she sets her sights on Picard, who hides out in the holodeck for the second half of the episode. And then everyone just goes their separate ways, and that's pretty much it. That is the entire rundown of what happens here.
This episode should be called Star Trek DTF.
Yes. It'd be a good spinoff. Well, what the hell? How did I want to start this? I think I had a track I wanted to go on. Oh, that's it. Besides the fact that this episode features Mick Fleetwood, the drummer from Fleetwood Mac.
Where was he? Who did he play?
He's the alien. He's the front alien.
The front alien?
Yeah, the fish alien that's in the front of the transporter.
Wait, hold on a second. One of those fish aliens is Mick Fleetwood?
Is Rock and Roll Hall of Fame Mick Fleetwood, yes.
He's going to fire his acting agent, man.
he should go his own way.
He's a huge Trek fan, and he lobbied to be on the show, so they're like, fine. They caved in, and they gave him a mask where you couldn't even recognize him. I think that they must not be Fleetwood Mac fans on the Enterprise.
No. Yeah, that must just be a very It's almost like when South Park was new and George Clooney wanted to be on the show, and so they made him a dog.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's kind of that sort of like South Park was doing it intentionally. Star Trek producers might not have been hip enough to know what Fleetwood Mac was. What I wanted to say was, I guess I wanted to start this one off by, this is Tracy Torme's final script. He wrote it under a pen name of Terry Devereaux or something like that.
That's a saucy name.
Tracy Torme wrote The Royale. He wrote The Big Goodbye, and he wrote Haven from the first season.
Well, he kind of wraps all of those things up into this one episode.
He does. And what I was thinking, I watched this one a couple times. I was thinking he left on bad terms. He was upset after The Royale with what Maurice Hurley did to his script. So he reduced his role. He's only called a creative consultant in this one instead of story editor. And he put a pen name on it. And I feel like this episode is, in some ways, is kind of a big middle finger to Star Trek. And I don't know if that was intentional or he was just super lazy and was like, fuck it. I wrote about these things in two scripts ago. I'll just do it over and pass that in and get paid and get the hell out of here. What'd you guys think of the episode in general?
Well, I think we need to have some words either off mic or on mic about these episodes you're having me watch. because I've yet to be present for one that was really good.
we had, I think Matter of Honor might have been one of the better ones.
Oh yeah, that's true. Okay. One.
Yep.
which is probably the ratio probably that you have watched good ones as well, having watched all of them.
Well, maybe if people are listening to this sort of live as they put them up, I took a week off and a lot of it had to do with, I was running out of enthusiasm for the second half of the second season, which is becoming quickly quite bad. Anyway, Sean, what'd you think? Any rough thoughts?
I know I'm the only, Luxana Troy fan in the universe.
Yes.
And I would love to defend her. And I think the problem with this isn't her. I gotta say, I mean, obviously the episode was not great. I think that her story happens to be the A story, and it's the only thing that really pushes the story forward.
Yep.
But yeah, I would love to have a better episode to defend her to you guys, but this is a tough, it's a tough sell.
You said any episode, this is it. It's a, it's weird because Clay, it's kind of the thing we talk about there, but it's a little bit of an improved version of stuff happens on the way to something.
Yeah.
This one's interesting in the fact that the stuff that they're on their way to doesn't matter whatsoever.
Yeah, it's a stuff happens on the way to something, but the stuff that they're on their way to is not any more interesting than the stuff that actually happens.
Right, and I have no idea what this conference is they're going to.
Yeah.
This is jumping way ahead, but this has the most bizarre resolution to any episode that I could possibly think of.
Yeah. I was watching this episode and I didn't hate it, but by the end of it, I just, like I said about my page of notes, I just couldn't find a lot of stuff to say, really.
Right. Yeah.
Like, it's not particularly bad. It's not, really poorly written. There's not really, usually what I end up doing when I'm on the show is taking whatever concept that they put in front of you that they failed to squeeze the life out of and punching it up in a way that makes it more interesting, you know, cause there's some elements that they don't take advantage of.
Yep.
This one is just sort of like, you know, aside from Troy's mom going on like a crazy hormonal, gangbang spree.
Yeah.
I don't really know what you could really do to push the story any further.
This episode just sort of lay there like a dead fish, you know, to continue the sexual metaphor. It's just like,
or to continue the metaphor of the beginning of the episode.
Yes, exactly.
Which I would like to say the one thing, I think that first scene is probably the best scene. I don't know if it's a best quality wise, but it is definitely the funniest.
Are you talking about when the fish beam over or what's the first scene?
Yeah. When the fish beam over.
Okay.
Because you have these costumes that looked like they were taken from like a Genesis concert.
Yes.
Yeah. And, Worf has a good line about saying, oh, I've never seen such a handsome race or something like that.
That was a bizarre thing to say.
Yeah. Andy. Yeah.
Sorry, Sean. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, I thought this was funny as a series of vignettes. Like, I was entertained by the jokes. I mean, a lot of the episodes are funny, but they're not supposed to be funny. This one was clearly written to be tongue-in-cheek.
Right. Yes.
I mean, there was very, very weak through line for it, but I liked each vignette as it was, and I laughed out loud a lot.
I'm glad you admitted that because, I thought it was genuinely funny sometimes. Like, my idea for the peak scene is, when Picard calls Data into his date with Loxana.
Yeah.
I think that's actually pretty fun. It's like a legitimately funny scene.
I didn't want to interrupt you, but I just wanted to finish my thing I was saying before. My favorite, I think the funniest thing in the scene was probably not written to be this way, but after they beam the fish guys over and they mention that they're in stasis and whatever, and Picard says something to the effect of, do you have a place you can store them until they wake up? And O'Brien's like, yeah, sure. Then the next time they cut back, they've just moved them to the side of the room.
In the opening scene, O'Brien says, I'll get them out of the way, and he literally just gets them out of the way.
He just pushes them like 2 feet to the side.
But it's that's kind of – sorry, go ahead, John.
When Loxana sees him at the end, she's constantly freaked out by these things, and she goes, I like them better with sauce or something.
Yes, yes.
They look like she says they look like seafood. It's so blatantly racist. In a race that doesn't even exist, obviously, but.
Well, in this one, it continued Wesley's through line of being the kid who's in the supermarket line, who's like, mommy, why is that woman so fat? You know, he's constantly bringing up, he's like, ooh, these aliens are kind of ugly. And he's like, you're pretty handsome for a Klingon or whatever weird comments he had to Worf about that.
Yeah.
What I was saying earlier about, this is sort of Tracy Torme giving a middle finger to things in a way that, like, the opening scene that you were just talking about, Clay, it internally makes no sense because they beam over and Picard goes, hello, welcome to the Enterprise, I'm Captain Picard. They all stare at them for 5 minutes and then Picard goes, they're in a coma and they can't do anything. It's like, so why did you say hello to them in the first place?
Yeah.
He knows what's going on and it's just this weird, none of this internally makes sense. He's just, I think Torme is trying to make fun of the Star Trek universe, and it comes across. This has been the problem with Tracy Torme scripts. I think he's trying to be funny because he was an ex-SNL writer, and his scripts
emphasis on X.
Yes, his scripts are trying most blatantly to be funny. They have like the most broad comedy out of any of the episodes.
Yeah, definitely.
The problem is that in trying to make things funny, the characters come across like they have no idea how their universe works.
Mm.
And that's most blatant in the holodeck here, where Picard has his favorite series are these Dixon Hill novels, right?
Yeah.
He goes on the holodeck and appears to know nothing about how the holodeck works or what Dixon Hill is about because he's blown away by everything that happens to him. Like, he doesn't know what a cigarette is. He's like, what is this alcohol you're giving me?
These are my associates. This is, Nails from Chicago, and this is
Carlos
from South America. This is Madeline, my secretary, and I want you to meet Rex. You know, I don't think I ever heard your last name.
Don't think I have one. Just Rex, that's all.
So, fellas, tell me your troubles.
Well, troubles. We've got some, Captain. It seems that a certain woman, both wealthy and beautiful now, thinks that she's going to marry me.
She's got looks and bucks? Sounds like you've got yourself one heck of a deal.
After there was an entire episode that focused on exactly that.
Right. And he's still confounded by the entire thing. It's
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mind Loxana not knowing the technology. Like, she beams in, she thinks her legs are missing, she doesn't call it a turbo lift, she calls it a turbo tube. she's like banging on computers to get them to respond, and she needs like runway lights to direct her to the holodeck, which she's never heard of. Like, I think that's funny and fine. Like, I was looking at a lot of the criticism of this. People seemed to be annoyed that she could exist in this future and not know any of these objects, but I thought it was kind of forgivable and kind of funny. She's fumbling around.
Sorry, Sean.
Yeah, Picard's different.
Say, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think it has anything to do with her. I actually, you know, my dislike for her character, I is only based on that first episode, Haven, that she's in. That episode as a whole is kind of hot garbage. But I think she's fine in this. I think she's, you know, she's good. The stuff that she does with Picard is good, and I like the I don't have that criticism that, you know, her misunderstanding of technology is out of place, because I mean, not everybody has been on a fucking starship.
Right. Know? Yeah.
Right.
I guess the.
Well, what do you guys? Sorry.
No. Go ahead.
I was asking, like, what do you guys? How do you feel? Why do people not like Loxana so much?
I can't answer that because I don't really know her that well. Like I just said, I haven't really found anything about her character specifically that
right.
comes off bad, but I don't know what the overriding opinion is.
I think the problem, my problem with her would be that she's a sitcom character inserted into the show.
Yeah,
I
agree with
you. She, I mean, she's really just the bad mother-in-law cliche.
Yeah.
Sort of come to life and.
Yeah, actually, oh my God, this just occurred to me. You know who she is? She's the, you nailed it. She's the mother-in-law from Bewitched.
As
the Samantha's mother, who is like the overbearing witch character.
Yes.
It's the same character.
Yeah.
You're
right.
Is it the same actor or just the same character, you mean?
It's not the same actress, but it's the exact same setup of a character.
Yes. I mean, she comes in. And no one's willing to put her in her place, sort of. So I think that's kind of an annoying thing about her. And it's just, I feel like her plots just aren't that interesting.
Right.
I mean, so far we've just had, she wants to get married and, or she wants to have some kind of sexual relationship in both of the episodes in Haven. She wants to set up Deanna with, her like betrothed or whatever. And in this one, she's hit menopause and just wants to bone her way across the ship.
Yeah, I guess my favorite sort of episodes of her are later on. So I might be sort of thinking of those when I think of her.
Yes.
But I mean, a lot of the cast are not really, I don't think are really great at acting. And I think she's actually pretty good and she sells it and she's tongue in cheek. And I think people, you know, like you said, she's a sitcom character. In a way, she's kind of in the wrong show and the viewers of Star Trek are probably not going to want to see a Bewitched character walking around the ship.
Yes, yes.
But I mean, my impression was maybe sometimes people are taking Star Trek too seriously when you have a character that's more tongue-in-cheek. Like, I wish that they would be able to laugh at it more.
Right.
A turbo lift is kind of a weird term for a thing. And, I don't know.
What a handsome race.
Oh, I was just going to say, yeah, there are so many... I would like to see how people respond to the Space Irish versus Loxana Troy.
Right.
Like, is it the same kind of, the same reason for the, disdain? Or, you know, I don't want to automatically assume there's like a sexist angle to it, but, it's possible.
It probably is. I feel that way with Pulaski a little bit. And I wanted to say that Pulaski's certainly gotten better as the season goes along here.
Yeah. They dial her down quite a bit.
And, well, in this one, she had that interesting, conversation with Deanna. Where Deanna's like, she's becoming fully sexually aware or whatever, and Pulaski has some weird, like, Picard's gotta work on his agility remarks.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just kinda, it's like, not particularly a crusher thing to say, which is interesting. Mm. It's different.
Yeah. I like when Troy is telling Pulaski in the hallway, and she goes, my mother is in heat, and she says blatantly what's happening, and she goes, if you catch my drift. I thought, yeah, well, you didn't even sugarcoat it. You literally said exactly what she's doing. She's in heat.
And Pulaski's like, we've all been there, baby.
Well, the weird thing is, like, this alien culture that, you know, this menopause is a big thing. She's like, we Betazoids call it the phase. And then Pulaski's like, do you mean menopause? And it's funny that, you know, there's this culture that's dedicated to something, but they come up with the stupidest name for what it actually is. Where the human version, you know, calling it menopause is actually like more interesting sounding than anything.
Yeah.
Just
it's like
we wanted to call it the phase, but the humans realized that's kind of insulting. So we changed it to something more sciencey.
It almost seems like in the attempt to downplay coming up with some weird name for it, they just totally whiffed.
Right. And yes.
It's even worse that they didn't come up with anything for it.
Yeah. They were going to call it like the bitchy slutty period, but that was too on the nose.
Or maybe in the script in the first draft it said, we call this parentheses phase question mark change later.
Yes.
And they just never changed it.
We'll update later. I think Bowman is getting close to being done here, but I like the way this episode is directed, sort of. I like the way, honestly, what saved this one for me is I think Patrick Stewart kills his comedy bits that he has to do here.
Yeah, he's really good.
He has two scenes. Well. He has the date with Loxana, and then afterwards in his ready room with Riker and Deanna is a fantastic scene because Stewart is playing it like it's a horror movie. He has this legitimately horrified look on his face as Riker is beaming, and Deanna is just doing her sort of flat explanation of what's going on.
Oh, man. Riker in this episode doesn't do a lot, but there are two scenes that are just like that scene where he, when Deanna Troi mentions the phase and Riker's like, yeah, you know, they become twice as horny as usual. And she's like, more like four times. He's like, what?
You never told me that.
His eyes light up and he turns to her and he's like, well, maybe call me back when you're 50.
Yeah, he had no reason to be in that scene other than to look back and forth and grin.
Yes.
Grin.
Why is he there?
She said, like, it's eight. There's no reason why he's there. She says it's eight times more powerful and he just will not take his eyes off of her. Even my wife's watching with me. She goes, Riker strikes me as somebody who you would see on To Catch a Criminal.
To Catch a Predator.
What's that? To Catch a Predator.
Yeah.
Catch a space predator.
And the other bit with him that I love that's just, I think I still am 100% in the belief that Jonathan Frakes is doing everything with his tongue firmly planted in his cheek.
Yes, I think he is too.
Especially you can see it in the blocking that he does. And this one, I can't remember exactly what he says, but it's the first scene after the credits on the bridge. And Wesley says something sort of like questioning, I think it's some sort of vaguely, I don't know anything about women or sex kind of comment.
Yeah.
And Riker answers him and he's like right behind him with his crotch right on top of his head. Like arms on his hips, crotch pointed out right at the back of Wesley's head.
Yeah, that was the scene where Picard comes in and sort of like lambasts them a little bit or gently tells them to like just because they shouldn't talk about an ambassador like that or whatever. And it's a weird scene. He's Riker's basically mounting Wesley's chair from behind.
He's basically saying, Wesley, do you like movies about gladiators?
And I'm starting to
Look, Loxana's assistant, is his name Hung?
Mr. Hom, I think. Homme.
Mr. Hom?
Yeah.
He's drinking the entire episode.
Oh,
he puts back, like, chugs five different kinds of alcohol.
And
he's
sort of in the background of scenes, he's drinking. It's like, when you just pay attention, he's like picking up the leftovers from the dinner and drinking the glasses. And
that's what I would do if I was hanging around with that woman.
I know. That's what I was saying. If she was like your master, it's sort of a funny little joke that he can only get through it by just being shit-faced all the time. That weird where he drinks like 2 gallons of that blue stuff in front of Picard and the scene is like 3 minutes long just watching him drink.
Maybe it's less that he's drinking to get through it and more that just, you know, hanging out with Loxana is a constant party.
Yes, basically. That was going to be my other opening joke for the episode, just being like, I'm sorry if I feel a little down, but I was hanging out with Mr. Hom last night, and you know how that guy parties.
I thought his name was Mr. Hung the whole time, and I thought, man, if she's really horny, why not just go for Mr. Hung? He's sitting right there.
He doesn't talk. It's perfect. It's exactly what she wants. Maybe she'll...
Oh, you know what? That's funny you say that. I noticed, and I'm saying this for Tana, who's probably going to be listening to this, I think Loxana Troi is a bit sexist towards men. I think a lot of her lines, if you had a male character saying it about women, you'd be in deep shit.
Oh, absolutely.
Like she treats men, obviously men are objects. She's like, oh, well, it's hard to find a man to challenge me. Usually I know what men are thinking. And, I like men that are quiet and you're too rough. She had all these kind of one-liners that, if you put it in reverse, if you had a man saying about a lady, then it would get you into trouble.
Right. Like her line to Worf, she's like, you're just primal and thinking violent thoughts. And it's like,
yeah.
Okay, flip that around. She's sort of the she's kind of a version of the outrageous O'Connor in a way. She's like an interesting sort of gender flip on that idea.
Yeah.
Where she's,
which then in itself is sexist because it's an older woman who no one wants to have sex with.
Right.
She's too aggressive.
And everyone wanted to bone O'Connor, even the men on board, but this is the complete opposite. And, you know, Picard is willing to sort of waste his time doing nothing. But I think I liked your point, Sean, about this. The episode felt like a bunch of vignettes that didn't really amount to anything by the end of it. The biggest vignette is just Picard completely changing tack and going into the holodeck for the second half of the episode.
Yeah, that was so weird.
Where he doesn't accomplish anything.
I tried to shoot him 3 different times. And he's just kept hitting pause.
It didn't occur to me in exactly the way you said it earlier, Wes. But I was thinking the same thing. Where he gets there and he doesn't have any idea what's going on. Like it
in his favorite program.
Yeah, he doesn't know why people. He's like, well, people keep showing up with guns. I picked this 1940s crime
thriller,
crime noir. I don't know why people keep trying to kill me.
What can I do for you, Mr. Bender?
It's about Alva.
You'll have to be a little more precise.
Okay, you want to play stupid. That's Jake with me. A week ago, a man came in here. He wanted you to find his girlfriend. Name's Alva.
Did I find her?
You know, you're getting on my nerves. You found her, all right. Face down in the river.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, we're all broken up about it. Especially the boyfriend, who's been indicted for murder.
And what are you here to do? Ask for a refund?
Nah. I'm here to kill you.
Computer, freeze program!
After the first attack, he's like, oh, computer, let's mellow it out a bit and let's, you know, let's redo this. And then this even more scary, dark, shadowy figure is just walking in.
Puts him in a chokehold.
Yeah. Scene go on. He immediately should have said, like, pause, like, clearly this is not going in the right direction.
I like that scene.
I did really like the third bit where the guy just kicks open the door with a machine gun. That was pretty
and
good.
And Picard flies against the wall and it's just like, computer.
You may continue.
Thank you.
You're truth ducking me, Hill! Computer, freeze program!
I enjoyed that scene. And in between each thing, he's sort of resetting his tie and everything. And like, we'll start it again. He does a little bit of a pratfall when the second guy, the computer disappears it and he like falls onto his desk because the guy's been holding him up.
Yeah. It is a little out of character for him to just start hitting on his secretary, I gotta say.
I noticed that too. He pushed, it's.
Well, okay. So I think that in there you have not being consistent with what you're doing with him because it makes sense if what he's doing is playing
the character
to the theme of that character.
Yeah.
Cause that's what those characters do in those stories.
Yep.
But if you're putting him in there and he, you know, clearly the only thing if you hadn't seen that first episode where he goes in and does all that stuff, you'd think, oh, he just goes in here and likes to sit behind the desk quietly and has no idea what these books are actually about.
Yes.
He never made it past the 10th page.
And that was a weird thing because when he shows up to go in there, he sits behind the desk and puts his feet up like he just wants to get away from Troy and he's just going to sit in this office for a little while. And he seems annoyed when, you know, the computer's like, well, the book does this. So these people are going to have to come in.
Well, it actually made me think about Sean, your Star Trek naps, where you would just let the DVD screen play.
Yeah.
And it made me think of that, because like, wow, that's awesome. Like, if you could go into the holodeck and pick your favorite world and just kind of like leave it on the menu screen so nothing's actually happening.
If she found him in where Geordi works and he's just sleeping underneath the computer console on the carpet, don't tell her I'm underneath the desk.
No, yeah, just that idea
that
of
big blue like strobe light engine thing.
just that idea of like putting in the program but never picking anything, just leaving it on the menu screen.
Yes.
So you have the world there and just kind of get the sounds and everything. That's kind of cool. Yeah. I like that.
Look out the window.
You need to just lights. Like instead of sounds of the rainforest, sounds of 1930s San Francisco street or whatever was outside the window.
Yes. Yeah.
lots of high-pitched, nasally news breaks coming over the radio about Poland being invaded.
Yeah, lots of references to World War II.
And
what is Picard's...
I like how he schools these imaginary people on the future of how America is going to be in this amazing country.
That's the problem with it. It's like, does Picard not understand that these aren't real people? Why is he telling the computer about World War II? Like, get into goddamn character. The one that I really did like was the, it's sort of meta where Picard's like, oh, Rex, I'm sorry, I don't need your last name. And the guy's like, I don't think I have one. And, you know, and it's just like, because... Yeah. In the book, that character wouldn't have a last name. So obviously the computer can't do it for him, but it was just kind of like a clever little tongue-in-cheek sort of nod to that, I guess.
Yeah.
He had a good line, something to the effect of, I appreciate that you're on the cuff, but you're halfway up my arm up to my collar or something like that, which is a really fun bit of like 40s, gumshoe slang.
Yes.
Yeah. Gumshoe slang. I like that.
It's trademark, Glenn McCormick, 2015.
Trick nap trademark. Sean Murphy. Every day. Did you guys notice that that bar, it looks like the same exact bar from Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
Yes, it sort of does. It's also, it's probably the same set that was used in 11001001, which is the jazz club. I think it's sort of the same thing.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Reusing.
Yeah, but it looks like some cheap Paramount lot.
Yep.
Set that they just have on.
Yeah, they throw a bunch of dust on it.
Another little tiny thing that I really appreciated. I think it's also in maybe that first scene on the bridge after the credits. Someone tells a joke or something and everybody laughs and Data laughs too, but he laughs like a robot. He kind of just goes, ha, 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 ha.
I kind of got something was unhinged with Data in this episode. When Picard invites him over, Data has this, like, it cuts to Data sitting at the bridge science station, and he has this weird look in his eyes as he's like, yes, Captain, I'll be right there. And then he was extremely excited to explain.
Like pointing in different directions.
Yeah. He was extremely excited to explain the brown star thing or whatever Picard was wanting him to do. He's like, that is a fantastic story. I will tell that.
I like when Picard's like, if your duties permit, maybe you could come by and blah, blah, blah. What if Data had said, actually, I'm really busy? Picard would be like, you know what? Drop what you're doing, Data, and beam here immediately.
A Romulan warbird just decloaked off the starboard bow, Captain. I have to stay on the bridge. Yeah. He's like, no. Bring Mr. Hom another bottle of liquor.
Did you notice that when Mr. Hom was referring to Geordi, he put his fingers over his eyes?
Yes. Vaguely offensive.
Pfizer. That's really offensive to handicapped people. It's like doing a wheelchair motion to refer to, I don't know, some character in a wheelchair, to Professor X.
Well, what's even more offensive, though, is the fact that they're like, yeah, let's go see him, and then he's not in the episode at all.
Yeah, he's the missing cast member from this one.
Like, clearly she walked in the door, got one look at Geordi, and was like, ugh, no thank you.
No thank you.
Yeah, his name should be Mr. Hung.
Oh boy,
he's no Wesley. Aww. Wesley will grow up to you know, one day he'll be a big strong man. I was vaguely uncomfortable when that was going to happen, but
oh yeah,
she's,
you know what they should have done. So when they get to the piece at the end where apparently Riker doesn't like to play along and he doesn't want to get into a cool suit when he goes to the 40s.
Explain to me why Data got dressed up.
I think Data just really likes the holodeck. Because, I mean, he and Geordi do that Sherlock Holmes thing that they get in full costume for. I think he just enjoys it.
Well, I mean,
which is really interesting on, like, a, like, to, that,
Data as a person
that's,
level.
That's kind of breaking my mind a little bit. Thinking about Data as a robot really enjoying play acting as a human inside a now I've gone cross-eyed.
Well, he's,
how do you imagine Data's robot? He doesn't enjoy anything except for oil or whatever.
Yeah, he enjoys this nutrient. I think that character, he's playing the same character he played in The Big Goodbye, the South American Carlos guy.
Oh, nice.
So he gets a chance to revisit that character. I don't know where, I mean, I sort of get the pun that Riker would be called Nails, but I don't understand why it really would happen. I don't know why Data gets dressed up. He doesn't even have a line when he gets into the bar.
I have a theory about why. When he walks in, his shadow is cast against the outside of the door.
Oh.
So the bartender's like, uh-oh, and they think it's going to be, you know, Knuckles McGee or whatever.
Yes.
the collector. And then you walk in, it's Data. Like, I would imagine that they might have shot more of a scene with some more dialogue, but they might have cut it out so that ended up not amounting to
anything. Yeah, maybe. I could see comedy in that, but I think that this episode might have the most tenuous link. You know, some episodes don't have a link between A and a B. This one sneaks in a slight Manhunt Dixon Hill thing where they're searching for a guy. And it's this weird, like, pseudo intentional link that you're like, oh, both of these are about trying to find somebody. And it's like, what a pointless link.
Well, that's tough though, because I wouldn't even call the Dixon Hill thing like a B story, because it
sort of becomes the A story in a way.
Well, it's not even really a story though, because he's just kind of hanging out there. He's not doing anything.
Yep.
And it's like I was kind of looking for that in this episode, because like the A and the B story are really, the A story is Loxana Troy in heat, and the B story is waiting for these fish guys to wake up.
Yes, yeah.
And which, you know, ties together oh so neatly with Loxana Troy being like, oh, they're assassins.
Get them out of here.
Get them out of here. Control S. I'm done writing for the day.
The fish thing is fascinating because along with the thing like we were laughing about, O'Brien just sort of moves them off to the side. The whole mission is to pick these guys up, right? And Picard goes, Doctor, do you have space for them? She goes, no. I'll put something together. Why don't they have space for them? It's the whole point of the mission is to pick them up and transport them around.
Well, they did have space. They had a nice cozy corner off the side.
But then she,
do you think he pushed them, physically shoved them, or do you think he beamed them 3 feet over to the left?
I think he flipped them like tires. Like he sort of rolled them over themselves and they just ended up there. But, what was weird was
like a caber toss.
Yes. Exactly. They just stuck there. The sort of a weird difference, but I liked how the preparation for them in sick bay is they just lay on the bed. I don't know what else she had to do, but she puts them on the bed. The effect where his eye blinks was actually pretty good.
Was that CGI?
I think it was.
And yeah, I couldn't tell.
It was like seamless. I was shocked by how sort of good it looked.
Well, the camera wasn't moving at all. That could have been not something as complex as CGI. That could have been something very simple. But if you just keep the camera steady,
it might have been
a freeze shot. And you just have this like,
quick optical. Or something.
I mean just in terms of like if you're trying to produce this show, what a waste of money these alien outfits were. they don't even do anything.
The thing that gets me about this episode is like these shows cost a lot of money to make.
Over $1 million in 1989. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean it, but that's super expensive.
Wait, how much?
These are over $1 million each in 1989.
Fuck you.
And imagine you're a stage crew guy and you're like, hey, why are we building this bar? Well, Picard's can be here doing nothing. Hey, why are we putting Data in this suit? No reason. Why is Riker's leg up near West? I don't know. Like, why are these fish here? Like, maybe they'll be terrorists. Like, there's so many pointless, expensive things that happen. And I cannot believe someone spent this much money on a script that just didn't go anywhere.
Even the, you know, to confound the pointlessness of them bringing food along, which amounts to absolutely nothing. Wesley is sort of a nosy little bitch and is like digging around in it when they beam over, which seems like it's an invasion of privacy. And then when they feed it to them, why does Worf just stick his hands into it and then like pulls up a big pile and then just carries that off? I didn't understand any of that.
I guess just showing him it was there or something so you can see how they act like animals.
How they're disgusting when they eat with their wet smacking noises that made me want to vomit. It's disgusting.
Why do you think, what did you think about Wes admitting that Worf is kind of handsome for a Klingon?
I think some of Wesley's strongest scenes are when he's with Worf. He hasn't had many, but they're kind of a good pairing at this point in the show. It's a weirdly sexual tension when he's wearing his little camel toe outfit this episode. So it's a little bit awkward, but outside of that, it's not too bad, I guess.
Yeah,
you're right. They do have a connection. I'm thinking about later episodes too, where there's a weird, that doesn't really go far, but it's nice knowing like the most, aggressive character embraces the wimpiest character.
Right. I do find that a little bit weird. Yeah.
Yeah. And it works. It works too, because, you know, on as far as the crew of the ship goes, he is the most, I don't know if there's like an elegant way to say this, but he's the most, exotic, really.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And so having
Wait, Wesley or
Worf.
Worf
and Data would be the two most, yeah, and
But Worf is more so because he's an actual person. So having Worf, having Wesley, who is younger and, you know, has never seen a Klingon before kind of thing, or, you know, who is a little bit, more uncouth about that kind of stuff, interact with him, I think works really well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
It's continuing the first, like, I don't understand why Wesley's there in the first place. Picard gives a throwaway line. He's like, I thought you might want to see this, which I don't really understand why he'd be involving Wesley in the first place, but it's, yeah, and he's just standing there. And what are Worf and him just doing, just standing there staring at these things as people are coming in and out of the transporter room? It's all very poorly thought out. They should roll their asses to sickbay.
So here's a question. Do you think this story would have been better? So this seems, it seems like it should be a bottle episode, but it's not, because they go into the holodeck and they've got this expensive set and all this kind of stuff.
You're right.
Do you think it would have been a better story if it had been more of a bottle episode where it was, you know, let's say that it was just Picard trying, you know, stuck in a room with Luxana or something where it was like more of them playing off of each other.
Yes.
Yeah. Like a Tom and Jerry episode with Luxana and Picard. No, I'm serious. I think that you could have just made it about her pursuing Picard and make it go even further with the comedy and make it even more awkward.
Right.
And funny.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
I mean, the whole through line of the episode is like, oh, Luxana is annoying and weird, but she did stop these two terrorists. So that's why you put up with her.
The casualness with which they deal, she's like, these guys are assassins. Everyone's just standing there. No one even moves. They just go, get them out of here then. And then she beams off and it's like, they averted what seemed to be a catastrophic event and they do it in this most low key way possible. Fleetwood
also
gets a line or something.
Also, that comes at the end of an episode where, unless Picard was lying, like there's a through line of Luxana's like telepathy not being accurate.
Well, they were asleep. They were asleep for most of it, so she.
Well,
didn't
no, 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 it, not that. It's like, well, there are a few points earlier in the episode where she says something, and I think it's specifically Picard is like, "That's not what I was thinking." And
Clay, I'm glad you brought this point up. I watched this twice recently. The first time I watched it, and I felt when I got to the end, I was like, "Oh, I think Deanna had a scene where she says that her mother is not operating at 100%. I was like, oh, maybe it's a side effect of the phase. They sort of lose their telepathy or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's not the case. So that would have been an interesting way, I think, to go to handle it. But I don't understand why Deanna never calls out her mother for lying, because she can tell that Picard does. Does Picard really have feelings for her?
Well, that's the thing. So it kind of plays into this ending, because either her powers are not at 100% and she is lying about, or at least mistaken about how Picard feels about her.
Yep.
Or she's not, and he's just covering in front of everybody else because of, you know, that when, as she's beaming out, she's like, oh, Captain, you're such a dirty dog.
Right. But why does Deanna never save the captain's face by going, everyone, my mother's lying. Like, this is not actually what's going on.
Everybody calm down. My mother is just a giant whore.
just a huge problem here. But I, you know, the other sort of aspect oh, go ahead, John.
I was going to say, I think maybe Troy, Luxana is just messing with Picard. Like, she knows that he doesn't, but
yes,
she's just fucking with him.
I think if that ended up, if
they made that true, it would validate her character a lot more, that she has a sense of humor about herself even.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, I agree.
But I think they don't write the character to have a sense of humor about herself. But with this rewatch, my main problem with Luxana is I feel like you could have something really cool with the Betazoids. Mm. And instead, they aren't played very well. Like in Haven, her introduction, she's presented as she's a little bit more pompous than she is here. But the pomposity is interesting because she comes from a race that they all know what everyone else is thinking, right? So for their development, it would make no sense for them not to sort of just tell people, like call out people, you know, like you're thinking about having sex with me. You're thinking about this because there would be no lying in Betazoid culture because there's no point to it. They don't really play that up. And instead, they just use it where Deanna and her mother can talk to each other without opening their mouths. And that's like the extent of their relationship with each other. I just feel like it's a little bit of a letdown because it's kind of a cool concept that they don't really explore.
Yeah. There's a novel, I've read some of the books, and there's one, it's like a parallel universe where Troy is evil, or the whole crew is evil.
Yep.
And Troy ends up taking over everything. And she's basically Darth Vader because she knows what everyone's thinking. People are terrified to be around her, like they clear their heads before they go get anywhere near her.
Yep.
And, it's really intense, and that's kind of, I think what you're saying, and it was a really great idea. It was amazing.
Yeah, that's a shame they never did that. That would have been awesome. That would have been a much better movie than Star Trek Nemesis.
I actually like Nemesis.
By the way, I just want to get this on record now.
Yeah.
That I am okay with sitting through these bad episodes because this validates me calling dibs on Star Trek First Contact when we get there.
Sure, sure. The
Four years.
We'll be in the phase by the time we start talking about I guess we can wrap this up, but I didn't hate this episode. I think I could come up with a lot of arguments about why I would rate it poorly. I think it made me laugh enough, like legitimately sort of, maybe not laugh out loud, but like chuckle or whatever. Some of the scenes are played very well. It's really just sort of, and I don't even mind the fact that it's sort of like you're saying a bottle. Like I like the fact that it's just sort of watching the crew go about their day in a weird way.
I agree.
I like those kind of little things. Like not everything has to be an episode where they're saving a planet or doing something. I just thought it's a little bit, it just doesn't succeed at what it's trying to do. And her playing cat and mouse would have been a better idea.
I would like to know how a person watching this at the time would respond to it. Cause if you're watching it week to week, it's, you know, when you're watching it now and you've got 100 something episodes that you can watch at any time with no hesitation, I feel like you can be a lot more, forgiving to the ones that sort of like, you know, don't cut it. But if this is the only Star Trek you're getting for that week, I wonder how it goes over.
Yeah, we talked about that on Twitter. I guess we can talk about it for a little bit here. But Alan Sepinwall wrote, I forget what he was writing about. He was writing about some show, but his basic gist of it was that, you know, in this new modern TV era, it's basically, you basically can't have a show that doesn't start well. You know, people will give a show a couple episodes, and if it's not kicking, people will just not continue with it.
Yeah.
And it's fairly amazing to think that Star Trek The Next Generation has had 50 episodes that are objectively not good TV, and they were still coming, which is a real difference in media. There was just no content in 89. You know, you had to go with these shows that were just not very good. And it's astounding that the show managed to stay and become a success eventually, because it is rough the first two seasons.
Yeah, I agree, man. I think it has to do with the type of fanship this has. We were kind of talking online on Twitter about this. I said I love the idea of Star Trek. I don't think any series has ever really embellished the idea as much as I would have liked. You know, it's like, if you read the idea on a piece of paper and get the sense for the characters and what Roddenberry was going for, it's almost like believing in a religion in a way, like hope. It's pushing the hope. And I feel like because you set it off with that mentality, you end up getting a lot of viewers who are going to stick with you during the bad times because they really want to believe that humans are not doomed, you know? And I don't think it's the episode themselves that they like. It's just you set the setting where it's like, I wish I was on that ship. I wish I had the holodeck. I wish we were going to different places. That's what survives. It's not necessarily the plot themselves. So I think people are very forgiving with Trek over other types of audiences.
I know what you mean. I had a similar experience with The Office, because The Office was a great show, but there was a point.
American or British are you talking about?
Well, both. I mean, but mainly the American one.
Okay.
Because the American one went like seven seasons or something.
Yes.
And there's a point where it starts to get objectively not good. But I kept watching it because I loved the characters so much that I just liked spending time with them.
Yeah. Yep,
because I have no real friends in the real world. So I have to interact with people over television and laugh along with them as they tell funny jokes.
They never say anything mean to you.
No, never. But that it's that kind of thing where it's like, you know, people be like, oh, why are you still watching that show? It's terrible. It's like, yeah, I know it's not great, but I enjoy these characters, so I want to continue watching what they do.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. It's a comfortable setting.
Yeah.
It's a place you want to be. So if the episodes are bad, it doesn't matter in a way because you still love the ship. You still love the idea of where they're headed and the possibilities.
Yes. It's just a crazy number. It's been 50 episodes. Some series that are my favorites didn't get 50 episodes. You know what I mean? It's like, this is a crazy, crazy amount of time. But it sort of goes against the argument of liking the characters because, well, I guess they're becoming sort of likable by now, but they're...
Well, what I meant more kind of... It's with Star Trek, it's with Next Generation, I know where you're going. And I mean it more in that it's what Sean was saying. It's about the experience of being there with this concept that you enjoy.
Yep.
So you can kind of look past whether or not they're, you know, nailing it on all cylinders, story-wise.
Yeah, I'd be interested in seeing what percentage of viewers in the early seasons were really just big fans of the original series.
Yeah.
And were sticking it out just because they love the original series so much that they were just like, well, I like Star Trek, so I'll keep watching this.
Yeah.
It didn't do gangbusters in the ratings. It did fine. It's certainly gangbusters by today's standards, but back then it was not really a huge deal.
That's the other thing, too. I've been listening to the Kumail Nanjiani's X-Files podcast. And one of the things he keeps pointing out is how, at least, you know, especially in the early seasons of the X-Files, they were not doing great in the ratings, but not doing great in the ratings in 1993 is better than every show on television now.
Yep.
And obviously that's because, you know, there's no internet and, you know, that kind of thing. So I think there was a lot more leeway as far as that stuff back then, just because people were just watching things.
Yes, you had to watch something, so they'll watch garbage if it's on TV.
Right.
And now we're at a point where there's too much good TV, and I get stressed out somehow because I'm like, God damn it, I have to watch this other good show and get through this. You know, it's like, oh, all these episodes of Daredevil are now on Netflix. I got to get through those. Jesus Christ. And it's like, it's just a weird situation to be in. As opposed to, you know, VHSing episodes of Star Trek on whatever channel it was airing back in 1989.
Yeah, and if someone came up to us now and said, I'm thinking about getting into Star Trek because I hear a lot of buzz, I mean, would you really recommend this over, you know, Daredevil or Sons of Anarchy or Breaking Bad?
No.
It's such a tough sell. I mean, I'd look at that person and I'd go, what kind of person are you? Are you interested in science? Or are you interested in theories and, like, these hypotheses of human interaction and all the stuff that Star Trek tackles? Like, you need a very specific type of brain to really get it. And you're not looking for a really good batting average. You're looking for somebody with some fucking patience.
Right. You'd have to add a caveat to that, though. You'd be like, do you like examining important issues in a half-assed way that doesn't always make sense? Like, you know, it's...
How do you feel about unintentional and kind of hilarious sexism and racism?
It's just that kind of a problem. Like, so many of the episodes now, you know, are regarded as classics. I feel this way, I guess, about Measure of the Man most of all. Measure of a Man is an okay episode. It raises a much more interesting discussion than the episode is capable of having, which is a problem. You know, they're limited to 45 minutes. They're limited to basically a G rating on television. So you can't go too deep, but... You know, I think it's what you're saying, Sean. Like, the idea of the show has never really been captured that well by any of the series. I'd say maybe Deep Space Nine got the closest to anything.
Well, it's interesting, too, though, because I was reading something similar about that, and it points out that the concept in its purest form it does not lend itself to interesting television.
Right.
Because it's very much, you know, we've evolved into this ideal society where everything is great and we're just kind of checking things out.
Yep.
And, you know, I mean, that's, we've talked about it before about why the first season of TNG has some problems, because these writers are trying to write character drama. And
yep.
Roddenberry doesn't want them to do that, because
right,
he doesn't want any character tensions or anything, because everybody is supposed to be great with each other.
Yep.
And it's really tough to, that's almost impossible to do.
It is. And I was thinking, Enterprise came out 7 years too early, because Enterprise actually starts to do, dark things with its, like, legitimately dark, like, you know, it's the founding of the Federation or whatever. The Vulcans are sort of holding back humanity because they don't want them to advance. So there's this weird tension between the species that you could have really played up.
Right.
And it unfortunately Enterprise came out in 2000 when you're like sort of at the Dawson's Creek era, like the, you know, the theme song is stupid and it's like
the theme
nothing
song is the worst.
Nothing's really good about this. But imagine, I think Todd Vandewerf, Vox.com did a thing about, If he was to bring back Star Trek, he'd do it as a 13-episode Netflix series and have it be maybe just a single self-contained story for that season.
Well, what's interesting is when I was watching Battlestar, the new ones, and that's like 2005 or 6.
Yep.
And Deep Space Nine was winding down or was already over. And it really became apparent how dated Star Trek allowed itself to become. You know, when you see how cutting edge Battlestar was, or even Firefly, it's like, man, Star Trek, you guys really did just go way too slow.
Yep.
You know, we're capable of watching something way more edgy, but you guys always played it safe.
Even,
and it was kind of disappointing.
Even just the way it's shot. It's shot in a very dated television way. You know, it's sort of shot with multi-camera, but they're not in front of a live studio audience, so everything is very, it's very obvious when they go either handheld camera or single camera shooting.
Right.
And it's just,
well, there's that in Q Who, it's one shot where Rob Bowman decided to put the camera down at the floor.
Yes.
And I think all three of us were like, holy shit, where did that come from?
What is the, and to bring it back to this episode, they have a nice crane shot in the bar when they sit down.
Yeah.
It looks pretty good. And the same with, he does some dramatic stuff with Dixon Hill's enemies when they come in. They're shot in shadow and stuff like that.
Yeah, that stuff, as soon as they started that stuff, I was thinking, man, why doesn't the whole show look like this?
Yes.
This is the stuff he's interested in.
Yes, and I think, I would assume it's a byproduct of the production schedule having too many episodes. You can't afford to be too artistic with your direction. You just have to shoot it and get it done.
Right.
Right. Just to tie into your thing, Sean, though, around this point, there was a young man who was somehow got his girlfriend to allow him to get him a tour of the Star Trek sets. And he did something that is generally frowned upon. And he brought a script and he gave it to Gene Roddenberry's assistant, who passed it along to a boss. And he was eventually hired to write that script. And it was Ron D. Moore, who eventually would go on to Battlestar and is actually one of the more famous writers who would finish up Star Trek for this season three onward.
Oh, wow.
He had a big beef with there's an interesting connection between Voyager, him like wanting out of that, because he was promised Voyager would be more like Battlestar. It would be aggressive. The ship would be falling apart.
Yep.
It would be hell. And it ended up being more of a comedy type Star Trek.
Yes.
So he was so mad that he was mad at, who's the guy that's like
Braga,
the protector of Star Trek?
Brennan.
Chakotay.
Well, there's Berman and Braga. Brennan Braga.
Chakotay.
Yeah. Yes, that's.
Yeah, sure. Shorman, I think, was the one who tied the thing around Roddenberry's statue. He had like a blindfold over Roddenberry's bust.
Oh, really?
Oh, man. I know we're going along here, but so, he had a bust of Gene Roddenberry in his office and, what's his name? Sherman?
Berman. B-E-R-M-A-N.
Berman. Sorry, Rick Berman. Yeah, Rick Berman. So after Roddenberry died, the writers started pushing him to get more aggressive. Like, let's have characters argue. Now that Roddenberry's gone, God rest his soul.
Yes.
Let's do some good writing here. And he's like, no. And he just kept fighting to protect Roddenberry, and eventually he felt like there was such a compromise that Roddenberry wouldn't like what the show had become. So he tied a ribbon around Roddenberry's eyes on his bust.
Just to not see it.
I guess it remains there to this day.
Yeah, really? Berman's sort of vilified as the man who ruined Star Trek. I don't think it's all his fault. I think they did do way too many spinoffs. There were way too many series in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But he refused to really update what the show was at that point. And, you know, TV's changing in the late 90s. Things are like, not that Star Trek's like Oz, but you're starting to get the HBO dramas and stuff like that, you know, like... They should have a prison rape scene in Star Trek to really bring things home. But it's, go ahead, Clay.
It's, you know, I think Roddenberry was kind of missing something critical. I understand his idea that he has a certain vision for the human race, et cetera, et cetera. But I think you can have both. I don't think it has to be one or the other where it's either everybody is on the same page and lovey-dovey, or it's all, you know, no lights and shooting people.
Right.
Because thing is, your story at the end of all this is still about people, and people are still people, and they're just, because they're not all going to act the same way.
Right.
So I you can still get the drama that just human beings will supply inside this core concept. It's not mutually exclusive.
Yeah. Yep. No, I agree. It's just a weird, dated problem that the show never really covered from. Eventually they get better at the storytelling to get around those weaknesses.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the AV Club described it best as Roddenberry was always a better salesman than he was a creative force.
Right.
Which I'd agree with. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was telling Clay on the phone, like, what does Roddenberry truly get credit for? All right, so he pushed a sci-fi show into mainstream like no one else had before.
Yep.
He really did populate the crew with diverse characters, women, minorities. So he totally gets credit for that. You know, he has the first interracial kiss. Like, he did a lot of stuff right. Was he a great husband? Was he a great father? Was he a great writer?
No.
All that stuff's debatable, you know.
And he seemed to be a bad coworker as well. You know, there's a lot of staff turmoil, and the people who were writing for him generally had sort of unpleasant things to say about the experience.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
That documentary
his son made was amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a really good watch. Not to totally tear the guy's history and legacy to shreds. But did you guys see that Scientology documentary?
Mm-hmm.
From what I know about Roddenberry in his later years, there seemed to be some sort of a slight parallel to the way L. Ron Hubbard was doing things. Because didn't Roddenberry also start doing, like, touring college campuses, talking about, like, the ideas and the futurist ideas of Star Trek and stuff like that. I find it interesting that, like you said earlier, Sean, it's kind of like a religion, and it kind of is, not in the sinister way that Scientology developed into, or supposedly sinister. I, you know, don't sue me or anybody. I have no money.
Podcast is over. No, it's,
we're gonna phase Clay out again. Turn his microphone down.
And when you look at them, Roddenberry bears a striking resemblance to Hubbard. They sort of look the same. They're like this sort of jolly old, you know, ruddy faced salesman who are just going about this thing. It's a very odd sort of weird situation. Yeah, no, that's a good point. But what do you guys? I think we'll wrap up because we're just hitting an hour. So we will play a clip and then come back with our ratings.
We thought since you were going to the same conference, you might like to beam down with the other delegates.
Oh, they're not delegates. Those two are assassins.
That is an outrage. Lies. We demand you transport us at once.
Don't bother to deny it. Your minds are so unsophisticated, I can read your thoughts in my sleep. Oh, their robes are lined with ultretium, highly explosive, virtually undetectable by your transporter.
She's correct, sir. I'm detecting large amounts of ultretium.
Well, of course you are. They were planning on blowing up the entire conference.
Mr. Worf, take them to level 5. Disarm them. Hold them for questioning.
Aye, sir.
Ah, well, I didn't find a mate, but I did save the conference. As
well as your reputations. All in a day's work, I suppose.
Goodbye, Mrs. Troy. And thank you.
Energize, Chief O'Brien.
Jean-Luc, shame on you for thinking such a thing.
So what would you guys give this thing out of a 1 to 5?
Oh, I'd go with a 3.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, wow. Or let's say 2.5. I mean, I feel like it's right in the middle where I didn't hate it.
Yep.
And I mean, there's nothing that stood out to me as being objectively bad.
Yep.
It was kind of inoffensive all around. Yeah, I mean, I enjoyed some of it. Some of it was funny. If there's like an idling, whatever your idling rating is,
right,
that's probably what I would give it.
Okay. Sean, what do you think?
Yeah. I'd go with 2.5 as well. It's a bad episode, but it's got a lot of charm for me. I think Loxana is able to get other characters to react in ways that no other visiting character gets. You know, I think she gives her daughter a lot to do, and she gets reactions out of Picard and all that stuff. I love it. And, even though it's not a great episode, I kind of appreciate how it just goes like balls to the wall with how gloriously bad it is. It doesn't really make any apologies. It's like you see the cliff and you don't even try to slow down.
Right. No, it does embrace what it is.
I embrace it for what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's funny. I thought I was going to be considered generous. I'm going to give it a 2. It's like we've all been saying, there's enough here that it's not a horrible, trudge. Like the idea isn't particularly offensive enough to really boot it down to a 1. I think it has some narrative problems and it has a couple, you know, sort of weird. It's really just a bunch of vignettes that are held together by the loosest of terms.
Yeah. It didn't occur to me as I was watching it, but once you said that, it kind of tightened everything up for me. Cause when I was watching it, I was like, this is structured really weird.
Yeah.
Because of how the second half is all just Picard, you know, hanging out in the holodeck with nothing to do.
Talking to a bartender.
Yeah.
Literally.
Completely disconnected from everything else that's going on. But if you do think of it as vignettes, it makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And some of them are good. It's like a sketch comedy show. You know, you remember the great ones, and then there's a lot of garbage in, you know, sketch shows once you move past remembering all the great sketches and you watch reruns of sketch shows, there's a lot of filler material.
Oh, yeah.
Just the nature of the beast.
For me, this might be the most laugh out loud episode of the entire series. You know, I'm curious to count like how many times I actually laughed genuinely, and I bet you this is up there as far as
interesting.
And I know that's not what people watch Star Trek for, but
yeah,
it might be an award winner for me just for the funniest episode.
The only one,
better or worse.
Only one off the top of my head that might challenge that is Data's Day, which I think has some legitimately funny moments in it.
And this one doesn't even have Joe Piscopo.
No, absolutely not. Don't need him. Don't need him.
There's one where Worf is in the Old West with his son.
That's I hate that episode. Oh man. A fistful of Data's.
Is that the name of it?
Yes. Yep.
I would like to also
see
Brent
Spiner with fake.
He's got a mustache.
Oh Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
And like a fake breasts, but they're clearly plastic.
Wait, does he like play everybody?
The computer sort of multiplies him on the holodeck, so he plays all the characters except for Worf and like Alexander, I think.
Oh boy.
Yeah.
One last note on this one, though. I would like to say again, if this is a season 1 episode, this episode's unwatchable.
I think if this was season 1, it's Haven, because I don't think this is different from Haven. You know what I mean?
Right.
Which is either interesting, and I guess it shows you how much you can improve on a concept if you give it a second shot. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Interesting. Well, thank you guys for coming on. Thank you for talking Star Trek.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Yeah, anytime.
Good to talk. I'll be back. We're wrapping up season 2 pretty quickly. What's after this? Emissary. A very important episode. I don't know if it's very good, but Emissary is after this. So thank you guys again, and we will see you next time.